Over the past few years, Jay Clouse has interviewed some of the biggest names on the internet. Everyone from Pat Flynn to Amy Porterfield, Seth Godin to Patty Galloway, Matt D'Avella to Ali Abdaal, and even James Clear. And that's just the beginning of the list. Now, with getting clout like that on his show, you'd probably think that Jay must have millions of subscribers, a huge team, and a budget to match. But the reality is quite different. In fact, Jay's brand, Creator Science, is only a couple of years old. He has less than 100,000 subscribers and a tiny team to match. So how has he managed to land interviews with such big names? Well, that's exactly what I wanted to find out. So today, I'm going to ask him. We became entrepreneurs because, more than anything, we want freedom. We want to be in control of our own schedule, income, and life. But unfortunately, that isn't always the reality of being a business owner. I'm Gillian Perkins, and I'm on a mission to take back entrepreneurship for what it's supposed to be. In every episode, I'll share with you how to get the most out of every hour you work so that you can work less and earn more. Let's get to it. So Jay, as a relatively small brand, how have you been able to get interviews with such big names?
I think it comes down to the literal message that I send that I've honed over years now. And some of it is social proof as well. So I'll explain both of those things. I would say 95% of the guests that have been on the show, I have reached out to absolutely cold. Didn't have an intro. They didn't reach out to me. It's just been a cold message to them. So the ability to capture their interest quickly is really important. So the messages all look pretty similar. Typically, the subject line even has interview request in brackets at the front. And then I'll say like, interview request, can we talk about your creator career? In the email, you know, I say hi and then their name. And then the first couple of lines is heavily personalized to them and their work and why I'm reaching out to them in the first place. It'll be something like, hi, Gillian, I've been following your podcast for a long time. I just listened to this episode, or I really liked what you said in this essay. Something that is very specific because I'm very picky about who I reach out to. So I always do have like a specific reason, and I usually know their work very well. And I make it clear that this is not the same email that was sent to a bunch of other people. Then I usually end that first paragraph by saying, I would love to interview you on my podcast, Creator Science, where we talk about your creative career. Then I put in bold, would you be open to a 45-minute remote interview? And then I put below that in bold, the pitch. And then I have a two-paragraph thing about the show. Creator Science is a high-production narrative interview podcast with 2 million downloads. It's been featured on these players, and it interviews people like Seth Godin, James Clear, Tim Urban, and Tori Dunlap about their creative careers. Then I say, if you're up for it, you can schedule directly here, and it links directly to the booking link. No pressure, no expectation. And if you need different times, please reply and let me know. Thanks for the consideration. Cheers, Jay. So a couple of things that I'll call out there that I think are important that might not have been obvious. I try to put in as much social proof as I can. I name drop some of the biggest names that have been on there so people see like, oh, well, if they've done it, then they must have done their diligence and it's probably worthwhile. I also talk about how many downloads we have, how many YouTube subscribers we have, which gets more and more impressive over time. And where a lot of people fall short is they still have too high of friction. Either they don't actually include the booking link, and you can do this in the wrong way too. Like, you want to include the booking link and say, no pressure, no expectation, give them an out. So it's not presumptuous. It's more about if you are inclined, let's just get this done. And then lastly, a lot of people email me and they'll ask, do you have time in the next couple of days or couple of weeks for an interview? And that time window is just too small. You want to give people multiple weeks, multiple months even to schedule this, because when the question goes from, do you have time in the next couple of weeks to, do you have time in the next few months? A lot of people are more likely to say, yes, of course I have time in the next few months than the next couple of weeks.
Well, I love how straightforward your pitch is, and like, it's nothing that unusual, nothing that fancy, and yet it checks all the important boxes. And I love how you included that social proof. You made it so easy for them. Honestly, that is the kind of pitch that I would say yes to if it was the right fit for my brand. right? If it was the right fit, the people I was trying to reach because of exactly the reasons you just said, that what I'm looking for when I say yes, or if I'm considering saying yes to a pitch is, does this brand have a big enough audience that it's going to be worth my time? Is this a person I actually want to talk to? Is it a good fit for my brand? And then after that, it's just like, I want it to be really easy, right? Like, I don't want to have to go back and forth via email with them. I don't have time for that. So one thing I'm curious about is, what percentage of the time do you use almost that exact same email? It sounded pretty generic, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but like that could be used for a lot of different people. Do you almost always send that same email, just customized a little bit based on, you talked about how in like the intro you talk about their podcast or their YouTube channel, their work, right? Other than customizing that, do you mention different topics to them that you might want to talk to them about, or you're always saying the same topic, which is the topic of your show?
Well, sometimes in that first paragraph, we'll call it, where I do the customization, sometimes I will share like exactly what I want to talk about. So I recently interviewed a YouTuber who reviews gym equipment, and I told him, I'm trying to put together an episode on product reviews, and I think you'd be an excellent person to talk to about this. So the first paragraph is the only thing that gets edited. And depending on whether I think the package that I'm going for is interesting to them or not. Because sometimes like interviews generally, I think, speak to people's vanity a little bit. So like the feeling of, yeah, I want to be interviewed. I'm important. That sounds awesome. I'm glad you want to interview me. Sometimes the topic of the interview that I'm interested in doing might actually make them less interested in doing the interview because it might be like really granular, or they might be like, ah, I've never talked about that publicly before. Because that is something I try to do sometimes, is talk to creators who have a large audience but haven't talked about the business side of what they do very much, that might not be interesting to them for me to call that out. But if I get them interested in the concept of the podcast and talking about their career, and then I can kind of pull that out of them in the conversation, I'll do that. So sometimes I'll put the topics in there, but a lot of times I don't.
Do you have any fun stories about interesting ways you've landed interviews in the past? I think I heard one about how you landed Seth Godin.
Yeah. Well, like I said, most of the time it's a cold email that I'm sending. And you always want to make a cold email or a cold message a little bit less cold. So with Seth, I had already had a pre-existing email chain with him for something pretty unrelated, but kind of related. He used to do this program called the Podcasting Fellowship. And I had done a previous podcast called Upside that went through his first cohort of the Podcast Fellowship. That podcast got actually a little bit of media attention. And when that happened, I emailed him just to say, hey, thank you for making this program. Because of that, this podcast exists. And it was just featured in Fortune magazine. And I just wanted to say thank you. And he responded quickly, as Seth typically does. And we're talking like a year later, probably, when I wanted to have him as a guest on this new show, I responded to that same email thread and said, hey, you might remember me in this podcast. I'm actually starting a second podcast and you would be an ideal guest. And I think something about that existing email thread allowed him to say yes, because he does typically have a rule of like, you've got to have 50 episodes in the bank for a show before he considers it. And he was literally episode one of this new one. So the more that you can relate to people in that way, I think is a good thing. Other times I've been like at an event and I've met some of the speakers and I'll like talk to them directly. I've been wanting to get Amy Porterfield on the show for a while. She was part of the HubSpot network, as was I. So you'd think that would be easy, but I wanted to get a little bit closer to her and her team before sending a cold message. Because again, like the more in demand somebody is, the less likely a cold message is going to work. So I try to find ways to speak with them directly or their team. Sometimes I'll meet someone on their team and I'll pass a request through that person. But you got to recognize that this is a long game. And even though you get a no a lot of times, I actually like getting explicit no's rather than getting no response, because when somebody sends me an explicit no, I can respond and say, absolutely no problem. Totally understand. Would you mind if I followed up in 6 months or so to see if this is more interesting then? And I'll almost always say, yeah, of course, feel free. And when that happens, now you have this email thread that's going on 6 months, 12 months, 18 months long. And eventually they'll be like, you know what? You're persistent and I can see that your show is growing. Yeah, I'll do it. So you've really got to keep ahead of schedule so that you're not really trying to like book a guest because you need to make an episode and air it next week or 2 weeks from now. You want to get ahead of the curve in terms of interviews conducted so that you have the luxury of as much time as these guests need.
I know you said that you normally are doing cold emails, but I think that, you know, what you went on to explain is how important those touch points often are, right? How that previous contact you'd had with Seth Godin, you know, led to him breaking his rule and being the first guest on your new show, and how oftentimes, you know, meeting people at events can be a great way. And I know a lot of us have a little bit of an icky feeling sometimes about like networking for networking's sake, but it does work, right? Like meeting people, it often does lead to opportunities that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't first met that person in a casual setting, you know, or just in a conversational way.
And specificity is really important too. Tomorrow in our community, we're hosting an event with a woman named Bonnie Christine. And she spoke at an event last year that I also spoke at, but we didn't have a chance to meet. But I loved her talk, and it was something that I really wanted to bring to the podcast. So I emailed her and said, "Hey, Bonnie, you don't know me, but we both spoke at Craft and Commerce last year, and I loved your talk about hiring and delegating. It's something that I really need to do a better job of this year. I would love to have that conversation on my podcast if you're open to it." And she responded, and she was like, "Oh my gosh, you were my favorite talk." And it was really cool. Like, we didn't actually talk or cross paths at that event, but knowing that we were in the same room, we saw the same things, it was very obvious that I had, in fact, been at her talk from what I said. That opened the door as well. I think we're still social creatures, just like longing for connection. And the more that you can create or find the connective tissue between you and whoever this person is, the more likely you are to be successful.
Yeah, I think that really speaks to how powerful it is to have something in common with someone else and how much connection that seems to create, at least it makes people feel like you have a connection. And I think people are always trying to establish that in their cold pitches, establish some point of connection, whether that is, you know, saying something you like about their content or whatnot. But when it is a real point of connection, even if it's something rather inconsequential, like you are saying, you know, you guys were in the same room, you know, does that mean that for some reason you will be a good fit for, you know, this person to come on your podcast? Not necessarily, but it's very meaningful to us as humans, as you mentioned.
Even if they say no.
Yeah, for sure. I'm curious, as we're talking about this topic of getting these guests on your show that are, you know, maybe significantly more well-known than your particular podcast is, you mentioned you spoke at Craft and Commerce. I know that that's a rather, like, I have a good relationship with ConvertKit. I do a lot of partnerships with them. And I've thought before, like, I would like to speak at Craft and Commerce. And I've talked to them about it. And they've been like, "We only have a few speakers. We try to choose people who, like, aren't really in the creator space, aren't really in the make money online space for the most part." You know, like, they'll normally have one or two kind of keynote people who are, but then otherwise they try to get people who are on their team and people who are doing other things. So I'm curious, how did you get that opportunity?
Good question. I don't really remember. I've been close to the ConvertKit team for a while. I give them a lot of feedback on the product, and I've been an affiliate for a while, and I interviewed Nathan on the podcast. I know they reached out to me, and I was enthusiastic and excited to say yes, but I don't really have a story outside of that.
Okay, well, you're telling me I'm on the right track because I'm doing all of those same things. And also, like, that's a trend that I've noticed with them is they like to reach out to people. Like, they don't seem to be very receptive to people asking them for things. But like recently they reached out to me about interviewing me and featuring me to their community. So it sounds like I'm on the right path if I want to speak at Craft and Commerce someday.
Yeah, I mean, there is an aspect of, you know, any event, there are human beings who are organizing it, right? And they have probably more responsibilities than just that event. But they realize one of the most time-sensitive and early tasks on their list is to start nailing down speakers that would be additive to the event. And they're likely just going to go into their brain and think, who would be a good fit? And sometimes it's as simple as like being top of mind for that person at the right time. And that's hard to know or predict, but the more connected you are to those people, and touch base with them in ways that are very natural. And, you know, some people could hear this and be like, I'm going to email this organizer every month for the next 12 months. That's probably not the best way to go about it, but whatever you can do to stay in their line of sight so that their natural recall brings you to mind as a good fit is going to help out. But yeah, everything runs on people. Everything is relationships.
So when you're reaching out to people about being on your podcast, what sort of conversion rate or success rate are you looking for? What would you consider a good success rate for your pitches?
I should be failing more often, to be honest. My hit rate is very, very high, and I don't send enough outbound requests. I would say all time, my hit rate is probably, it's above 75%. So really what I should be doing is sending more requests, because you actually want to reach higher and get rejected because your life doesn't change. And sometimes they say yes. So a trap that I've fallen into recently is just not making enough asks. And when you get comfortable with who you're reaching out to, because you know they'll say yes, because you know them, that's the time to reflect and be like, but who do I want to get that I don't know and say yes? And send some of those out. It's really hard for me to get over the initial hump of like sending the first cold email to somebody who I don't necessarily expect will say yes to me. Mm-hmm. But it seems like once I get that first one out, then I can kind of fall into another four or five pretty easily. So, you know, I think you'll find your own benchmark, dear listener, and you should just be striving to get the best guests as possible on your show. I don't even know if the hit rate matters so much as once you figure out your hit rate, just send more requests so that you get enough yeses from the people that you want to have on the show to really grow things.
You talking about this mistake that you've made of not sending enough pitches to get rejected more so that you, of course, can get more yeses from more cool people also leads me right into my next question, which is, what mistakes have you made with pitching in the past and what changes have you made to get better results?
Well, the most obvious one is if you are pulling from an old email that you sent to somebody else and you forget to change some aspect of it in the copy paste, you know, if you start off the email with, hey, and the wrong name, you're in a bad spot. That's going to be a no. So be very careful that you add the right name. That's the first one. Second one, I think as you go up the ladder and you get more and more difficult guests, I have found that they have much stronger boundaries around when they do interviews. Let me give an example. I had James Clear on the show as episode number 2. I'm close enough to James that I can text him and ask him questions. And I said, you know what? It's time for a second interview with James. So I texted him and he says, hey, as a rule, I'm not doing any interviews right now, but if you email my assistant, we'll put you on the list for when we start doing interviews again. And that's the type of message that I consistently get from people like James, who their no is kind of like a not yet. They just realize like, hey, these appearances should serve me. And I'm going to organize my life around my most important projects. And if this interview can be additive to that, great. If not, it's going to be a no for right now. So it's some combination of that, or like, hey, I'm really focused on some deadlines or some projects, or I have some other commitments right now. And I think that's another reason to be proactive in sending a lot of messages, because you don't know people's priorities or timelines. And you actually get some interesting, rare opportunities when somebody is just emerging from like a deep work project. You know, you see it very obviously with authors and books. You look at your podcast app and you're like, oh, wow, Charles Duhigg is on all of these podcasts right now. He must have just released a book. And that's like an obvious one. If someone finishes a book, you can go and do that. But it can work with any project for any type of industry. If you want to get somebody in there busy, like try to time your ask with a period of time when they have finished a project and they want to start promoting that project. That can be really, really big. That might be as simple as like finding an author's publicist team or the team at a publisher to get to know that. Otherwise, you're really not going to know unless you ask and they say no. And you say, okay, when would be a convenient time? That's the nice follow-up is, when would be a convenient time? Or do you have any projects that you would love to promote in the coming months so that I can make this timing work for you?
So I'll just add that I sometimes send that message that you were saying James Clear sent you of like, please email me instead, basically, if people text me or if people message me on Instagram. And a lot of the time it actually has, in my case, not very much to do with the timing, but more about my systems and processes. We have a system for handling pitches that come into a certain email address inbox, partnerships@GillianPerkins.com. And if people email us there, then we have saved replies we can send to them. Things can get added to Asana from there and it will get handled properly. You know, if it's a good fit, it will get booked. And if it's not, it will get politely rejected. Whereas if someone messages me on Instagram, if I were to try to pursue that with them on Instagram, I would be incredibly flaky. I might say yes and then never book it. I might forget to say no, even though I meant to say no.
Yeah.
It would just be a mess, right? Because there are so many things pulling at my attention and I don't consistently go into Instagram or consistently, you know, maybe respond to a business related text and I don't have that system built up there. And so I think that that like is a good something for people to know, especially if you have a really small brand right now, if you are a solo creator and you are pitching people who have bigger brands, that you actually have a higher chance of getting a yes if you message them in the right context. However, also messaging them on the wrong platform can sometimes be powerful. Even if they say, please email me instead, you've made another touch point and now you have a tiny little something in common.
Yeah, that tends to be where I fall because, you know, the honest truth is it's not hard for these people to recognize who has the leverage in these situations. And it's like very obvious that most of the time these people are doing me a favor. And I try to make it harder to say no. Okay, I have one more thing that's a mistake that I think I used to make and a lot of people commonly make. My show is predominantly an interview show, but I don't really think of them as interviews anymore because in the past, like the role of the guest in my show was to try and get viewer attention based on the name. Like I was basically packaging the episode around that person. And I've learned a lot and think a lot more about packaging as a concept. Packaging meaning whatever the thing is that you interact with for this piece of content, that is its package. And so a lot of interview shows package around the guests and are like, I talk to awesome person about their awesome life. What I like to do is package my episodes around an outcome or a specific problem or insight, and then say, who is the best person to deliver that message. And so it's actually moved me away a little bit from like the big, big names because I was doing more of like a clout chasey coattails approach to interviewing. And now it's like, I am building a body of work, almost like a curriculum. And I look for holes in my curriculum and say, who is the best guest lecturer to bring onto the show to talk about this? I think whether you go that far into like the education design of it, or if you just want to think about how you're going to package this to be listenable or clickable, if you're doing it on YouTube, you should really think about the package of the episode before you even do the interview so that it guides your questions. You know what you're talking about. And now it's not, hey, we're interviewing Jay, the founder of Creator Science. We're interviewing Jay to talk to us about how to book great guests. Your team did this exactly this way. Gillian was reaching out to me and said, hey, we want to talk about how you book guests on your podcast. And I think that's like such an underrated way to go about an interview show.
Yeah, this is rather meta, right? But I saw a couple similar things happen here. One is I've noticed, and I think I've been really pleased to see, I think a collective shift in people realizing that it actually works better to package the episode around the topic or the outcome or the problem that's being solved rather than the guest. And how I like personally discovered that was I had some bigger name guests on my show, on my YouTube channel, and watched how poorly those did when I packaged it around just the person. It's like, yeah, the person is well known, but everyone has already seen that person before. So if you just package it as like interview with such and such a person, that doesn't really give them a reason to watch that episode. However, when you package it around that topic, that outcome, that problem that's being solved, then it gives a lot more opportunity, I think, for like for people to see the value of the episode, have a reason to click on it. But also when you have a smaller guest, it can still do really well. Whereas if you try to package it around the guest name, then when you have a smaller guest, of course, it's going to do even more poorly than when you have the big name guest. But yeah, I've just found that to work a lot better there. But then also the other thing that made me feel like this was meta was you were talking about how I had, or my team rather, had emailed you about talking about booking guests. And I had had the exact same thought you mentioned earlier of, I don't know if he'll want to talk about that. Like, maybe I should tell him what I'm going to talk to him about, because like, I don't know if that topic will serve you, serve your brand, but I'm delighted that you said yes, right? And that you came on here, were willing to talk about that topic.
Yeah. I mean, you get to a point also, maybe this is too related to content creators to be useful to the typical listener, but I've also started to recognize that the people who come on the show are publishing all over the place all the time. And so if we can have a unique conversation that creates unique assets, you know, video, then they can actually use that on their channels too and not be saying all the same things all the time. So sometimes it plays in your favor. It's kind of an art to know, when do I share the packaging with the guest ahead of time before we get on the call? I usually share the packaging in like the pre-talk before we start recording, but usually I get them live in Riverside first.
I have not been that bold, I will say. I normally say the packaging in the initial email, tell them exactly what I want to talk to them about. However, that might have been to my detriment. It might have made some people say no that might have otherwise said yes. Okay, I'm going to interrupt myself for just a moment to tell you about another podcast that I have. So recently I recorded a 10-episode podcast, just a limited podcast series called The 100K Method. In this podcast series, I break down, well, exactly that, The 100K Method, which is my automated sales funnel strategy. So basically, this is the strategy that I use to generate passive income in my business to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. And I want to teach you how to implement this strategy in your business. So I went through, I recorded 10 episodes all about the 100K method, breaking down for you exactly how it works, every step of the process, from the webinars that I use to the emails that I send, how to promote your business without using social media, but instead switch to more passive strategies so that you can fuel your 100K funnel with what I call ready to buy leads, and how you can implement this whole system into your business. Basically, I'm teaching you my whole system for free in this new limited podcast series. To get access to the 100K method and binge the whole thing, all you need to do is type in the 100K method into whatever podcast app you are listening to this podcast on, or you can just search for my name, Gillian Perkins, and it should pop up. I'm also going to include a link to the 100K method podcast series in the show notes for this episode so that you can easily find it there as well. I hope you really enjoy listening to this new podcast series from me. Make sure that you leave a review, let me know what you think, and share it with anyone else who you think could benefit from a 100K funnel in their business. Okay, now let's get back to today's episode. So I'm curious, as you have booked interviews, you know, you've done a lot of interviews over the past few years, especially. What kind of impact has that had on your business? Have you had very many people reciprocate and ask you back onto their show? Has it impacted your business and your brand in other ways? What have been like the biggest highlights or the biggest value that you've gotten out of doing these interviews?
I've definitely built some real relationships with the guests who have been on the show, especially repeat guests. Sometimes you just vibe and you're like, we could be friends. And so it's not usually so obvious and so overt that I end the conversation with, we should be friends. Give me your phone number and we're going to text now. But, you know, after you have a good interaction, then I follow up. I send a thank you. I interact with their content on whatever platform. So they just kind of continue this feeling of like, Jay gets me. Jay is someone that I enjoy interacting with. That's probably the most obvious one. Has there been reciprocation of being on their show? Not all that often, to be honest. I think the thing that could be pursued more on my side is joint episodes or feed drops. Meaning, a lot of times when I guest on other people's shows, I will ask them, hey, can I re-air this episode on my feed? And usually what I'll do is I'll record like a 60-minute custom intro and be like, hey, this is Jay. I just want to share with you a bonus episode this week. I recently spoke to Gillian Perkins on her podcast, Work Less, Earn More. I thought it was a great conversation. It was territory I haven't talked about publicly very much before. So I wanted to just share that here in the Creator Science feed. And then I'll say like, I'd love to hear what you think about this episode. You can tweet at me at Jay Klaus, but we'll get to that episode right after this. And I'll go into like the pre-roll ad then. And then we'll play the episode in full.
So now you've already taken care of that. So now when you air this on your podcast, you can just clip that segment out and put it at the beginning. Work less, earn more.
Exactly. I can tell from that response that you're like, I'd be interested in that. And most podcast hosts are. It's like, oh, so I get to show my full episode to your audience, give a good taste in that feed. It's one of the best ways to grow a show. And for me as a guest, it's like, this is awesome. I have an extra episode that I can either put in place of my regular material, buy myself a week of time, or do a bonus episode and just bank an extra episode's worth of downloads. And my audience gets, you know, more time with me. So I think that's something that people should do more and I should do more. The other thing that I mentioned was like a joint episode is it's kind of like that, but a little bit more proactive, where it's like ahead of time, you know, like, hey, let's do an episode together and let's just air it on both of our feeds. The feed drop is kind of a bit of like a reactionary way of doing it, but a joint episode is a little bit more proactive. I had someone else reach out to me recently to ask to do that. And I was like, man, I should just do this more often, because what I found is cross promotions are not very effective. I don't know if they ever were effective. People led me to believe that they were, but like a short 30 to 60 second cross promotion of a show is not super effective. Being a guest on someone else's podcast is a great way to grow your show. And joint episodes or feed drops are more effective than cross promotions also. So that's something that's on my mind.
When you're talking about cross promotions, you said a short 30 to 60 second. Are you talking about where you put an ad in each other's show?
Yes.
Okay. And you've tried that and you didn't find it to be very successful?
Yeah. I mean, that's the premise of a lot of podcast networks is, hey, we're going to help you grow your show. This is a network of related shows. And we're going to facilitate the sharing of cross promotions throughout the network. And I did that. I was in the HubSpot network for a little over a year. And that was predominantly because if I was going to join a network, that was the most aligned network out there that I could find. But those are like once monthly. So over the course of 14 months, I did 14 cross promotions, maybe less. And there were more than 14 shows. And you don't always have agency over which show you're being promoted on. You could try to be a squeaky wheel and get some grease. But ultimately, it wasn't in larger shows that had more of an audience that would have a high enough top of funnel to drive meaningful bottom of funnel conversion to listeners. So I'm going to keep doing it, but I'm going to be much more targeted in my own approach, doing it on my own. And I think that'll operate better because it really comes down to enthusiasm in the cross promotion itself, I think. You know, people can tell like, oh, this is just a 30-second ad read that this person was forced to say. I don't believe what they're saying, that this is a show they like and that they listen to. Whereas if it is genuinely a show that I like and I listen to, I'm going to deliver a much more compelling ad read or cross promo for that show that's going to lead to more listens. So I'm just going to be more targeted moving forward.
Yeah, I listened to several different podcasts that were part of the HubScout podcast network. And I had that exact same thought of like, this is interesting, but I never once went and listened to the other podcast that had been cross-promoted because I didn't really believe, just like you were just saying, I didn't really believe that the person who was promoting it really believed, really cared about that other podcast. It didn't seem genuine. And so, yeah, I had no interest. It was very not convincing to me. Whereas if I was listening to a podcast and in the middle of the episode, the host of the podcast randomly, casually mentioned a podcast that they'd been really enjoying and genuinely talked about it, I absolutely would go listen to it. So I actually would disagree about the cross promotion doesn't work. And I'm suspicious maybe you would too, right? But it really has to be genuine. And I think the other thing that made me not believe it was the fact that it was often a different show every episode. So like in every single episode of the podcast, the host would talk about some other podcast they were loving that was in the Cub Scout Podcast Network. And so that made me feel like they didn't really, you know, listen to those other podcasts. Whereas if there was a podcast that in multiple episodes, they mentioned some other podcast that they listened to, I would probably believe them.
Yeah, I think an enthusiastic, authentic recommendation can totally work as a cross promo. I think it's going to be even more effective with a feed drop or a joint episode, because now you also have a lot of time with that person. I still think it can work. So I'm still going to try it. But like I said, it's going to be much more tailored to my circumstance, where I can be very genuine in how I deliver the ad. And I expect the other party will be as well, because that was the bummer of it, was I can be as enthusiastic as I want to be on behalf of this other person, but I can't really control how they deliver it. And yeah, it just didn't quite work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Another example of something that's similar but quite common is how in an interview episode, a lot of the time, certainly not always, but often at the end of the interview, the guest will get an opportunity to, you know, plug their other social media. And if they have a podcast, oftentimes they'll mention the podcast. If I enjoyed that interview and I want to learn more from that guest, I definitely would go listen to their podcast. And I've done that multiple times.
Yeah, same.
From a broader perspective, what are two or three things that have worked really well to grow the Creator Science brand or increase your earnings over the past year or so? Like, just what are two or three things that are working really well for your brand or business?
Well, the first thing was change the brand itself. I'm guessing the last time we talked, it probably wasn't called Creator Science, actually.
No, it was. That's actually what we were talking about last time. It was shortly after you'd made the change to Creator Science, and I saw what a genius move that was. And I was like, I want you to come on the show and talk about why you did this and how you did this and what it's doing.
That's the biggest difference for sure.
But you can talk about it more now, because probably most people haven't listened to that. So plug the episode we did before.
Yes. So if you haven't heard about this, go back and listen to where I was before I made this change, or right after I made this change. I was doing ostensibly the same thing. Like, I wrote a newsletter, I had the podcast. Newsletter was called Creative Companion and the podcast was called Creative Elements, because at that time I hadn't latched onto the word creator all that much. I was helping creative people build a business around content. But I was frustrated because I wasn't seeing my name or my work referenced when people talked about creators or the creator economy. And I just thought, I don't think this brand is working. So I put the word squarely in the name of the brand, Creator Science. And I don't think it's just having the word in there. I do think that there's the like seeming juxtaposition of creator and science in the name. Like, I think there's a couple elements that make the name work, but changing the name and then applying that to both the newsletter and the podcast and just like the overall digital footprint has been a night and day difference. And this type of thing also self-perpetuates, because once people start saying like, who are the best people to follow related to creators? And they say, Jay, Creator Science, it just starts to get repeated. There's this amazing book called Hitmakers by Derek Thompson. He's a writer for The Atlantic, also has a great podcast called Plain English. So there you go. There's an enthusiastic recommendation of a podcast. He wrote this book, Hitmakers, and the book starts with a study of Impressionist painters and asks the question, why were these Impressionist painters the ones that got known for Impressionist painting? They weren't the first, so why are they the ones that we know as the best painters? And he explores this question, and the conclusion he comes to is there was this moment in time when this wealthy benefactor bought a bunch of artwork from these painters in particular, and he donated it to the government upon his death under the condition that they were placed in a gallery. And it was like a very presumptuous thing, but somehow it worked out. He dies, they get the art, they put it up in this gallery. And as people come to the gallery, these are now the Impressionist paintings that they see. Now it's in a gallery, it's going to go in textbooks. Now it's in textbooks, this is what it's taught as the artwork that is important for Impressionist painters. And you apply hundreds of years of time, it's just perpetuated the truth that these are like the Impressionist painters. Same thing applies on a smaller scale when you get known for anything. It just starts to self-perpetuate. And now that the ball's rolling, it's really doing everything else. Of course, there's like saying yes to the right opportunities, speaking at events feels like a big thing, but it's probably not that big of a thing. Like, I don't think the act of speaking at the event is the big thing. I think that the more you stack credibility and legitimacy, that kind of perpetuates things as well. The YouTube channel has been big over the last 2 years or so. It's a little less than 2 years old. And that has quickly become like one of the biggest top of funnel audience growth elements of the business. And even that success is really tied to like a couple of videos. We've published over 100 videos at this point, but there's six that are 100,000 views and above. One is 2.5 million. So like those six videos, and especially that one video, have done the lion's share of growing the channel and continue to bring people into it. So it's, in some ways, it's like a hits business. Even on social media, you have some posts that just hit bigger than others, and that drives a lot of new followers or subscribers. And so you got to stay in the game long enough to stack up a couple of hits. And hopefully there's alignment between what you do, what people know you for. A great brand name isn't a make or break, but it certainly helps. So yeah, I think those are the three-ish things that we've done well.
What does your product suite currently look like?
It's changing a lot because I did this absolutely wrong to start. So right now, current state, what we have is a membership called The Lab that does the lion's share of my revenue and has 200 customers. I built this product for, I say professional creators, but I was talking to somebody today and they didn't even understand really the extent to what I'm saying. The people that are in The Lab are my peers more than they are my fans. Like the last time I ran the math, the average creator in The Lab was generating $26,000 in revenue per month. So like it's a group of people that are doing real business. Like it is their full-time thing. And statistically, I know from the data that I collect, only 13% of my audience are likely qualified for that product. So what am I doing with the other 87%? Not much. I have a couple of like one-off mini courses that work. One is called a newsletter masterclass. If you're interested in newsletters, that's good for you. I have a podcasting course called Podcast Like the Pros. But again, I also know that a very small percentage of my audience is interested in doing an audio podcast. I have a membership course called Build a Beloved Membership. Again, a small percentage of my audience is interested in doing a membership. So going back in time, if I could do it again, what I really needed to do was identify what is the signature product that I want to build for Creator Science. What is like an entry level product that I want to build for Creator Science? Ideally, both of them serve the average subscriber to the Creator Science universe. And instead, I built all these like highly specific niche products for specific types of creators. And it made it challenging to know what to market to who and when. And so now I'm going back in time and fixing some of that. We're recording this in early April. I'm launching my next product in 2 days, probably out by the time this is aired. It's a templatized version of my Notion setup. So that can serve any creator that enters the ecosystem that's willing to learn Notion or uses Notion. And I'm really, really optimistic about the power of this product because it's something that I can market and sell all the time to anybody who falls into the creator science realm. But long answer to your question, my product suite currently is not ideal.
I don't think it's necessarily a big problem that, like, I don't think that The Lab is a problem. The fact that it only appeals to or is only right for a small segment of your audience, you know, if it's really right for a segment of your audience, then that can be huge. I agree that it'd be better to have a product that was a good fit for the majority of your audience, but not instead of The Lab, just in addition, like have one more product, like you're saying, right? And then your product seems similar to how mine were a few years ago when I had several very specific courses, which I know some people get that to work really well for them. But I think that with my kind of minimalist business strategy, it didn't work for me because I needed to have more of like one thing to focus on, or maybe two things, which is kind of where I'm at right now. Like I have a membership and then I have like one main course that I sell that is more of a a general topic. It's not like something so specific as like email newsletter or sales page or podcast, something like that. It's more about like the same main thing that my brand is all about. But
yeah,
obviously it's a process, right?
It is a process. Something that I've noticed though, and maybe you've seen this too, like when you ask, you know, what's been good for growing your brand, there are a good number of examples of people who have nailed their signature product so well that the product itself, like the bottom of the funnel, actually becomes top of funnel because it's just so good and so revered and has so much positive word of mouth that it becomes its own engine for driving people to the brand as a whole. And I think that's a much smarter, simpler, elegant model, is to come out of the gates and say, I understand the premise of my business. I'm going to create a signature product that kind of delivers on that premise. And I'm just going to rinse and repeat and make that better and better and better and better so that it's hard for people to outcompete me on that promise. And just stick with that. Like you said, like have one thing and then eventually you'll say, okay, let me make a more entry-level product that kind of lines up with this, but gives people a lower risk way to test working with me. That's really all you need. And yeah, I over-engineered things, in my opinion.
I agree. It's much simpler, much more elegant to focus on taking one product to like developing visibility for one main product rather than trying to get visibility for your brand and then give people maybe free things or sell them entry-level things and then eventually tell them about your really expensive product. Like just have one great product, make it really great, make sure it has a good name, right? And then market the heck out of that thing so people know that better than they know you, which I feel like you've done that really well with, I know this is like a little different, but with the Creator Science brand, where it, that has become something that people know more than they know you necessarily, but it's stickier, right?
Yeah.
It's easier to differentiate your brand than it would be for you to differentiate yourself as like a podcast host or an interviewer. And I think the same thing happens with a product, where it's easier to differentiate your product with its unique name and its branding and everything that it stands for and it does, rather than like you as an individual, because people are remarkably similar, right? Especially just like at a glance, right? Yeah. So easier to make a thing be different than a person be different. What were you going to say though about some examples?
I was just going to share some examples that people were thinking like, what is an example of a signature product that drives top of funnel? And some things that come to mind are Ship 30 for 30, Building a Second Brain, Rite of Passage, Rachel Rogers' Millionaire Club, B-School by Marie Forleo.
That's a classic example, right?
Rehashed so many times. Rehashed meaning like they've just improved and iterated on it so many times in a row. And there are so many people that are in there that you might hear about the product before you know the creator of the product.
And something that I think is interesting is like, you just mentioned several products and some of them I recognized and some of them I didn't, but they stand out to you. Like you are aware of that product and it stands out to you more than an individual maybe stands out to you.
Probably.
And I feel the same way. Like there's a bunch of products that I could list as like they stand out. And I don't mean like that you don't remember the person or you don't, maybe look up to the person or respect them, but the product you're like, oh, wow, this thing is special, right? This thing is unique in its industry or its space. It is the gold standard. It's like the Kleenex of that thing. And I definitely could, you know, list many products that I feel that way about too. They're the Kleenex of their industry, which is different than how I feel about a lot of the people. The people, it's like, oh, they are one person who talks about this thing and other people talk about this thing too. But their product is more unique.
This is why I ended up going the route of building like a third-party entity rather than doing like the J. Klaus personal brand. Because when you say you're a creator, the question is of what? And what I wanted to be known for was creating something that you had heard of. To me, that was like the gold standard of what I wanted to achieve. Because you're right, like the people behind some of the things I just listed, Ship 30 for 30, Tiki Bush, Building a Second Brain, Tiago Forte, Rite of Passage, David Perel. I know those people because they're the creator of those three things I just listed off. So like it was very much the product, the experience, the thing first, and the legitimacy of that thing created a halo effect around the individual to where now I respect, admire, follow the individual.
Well, on that note, Jay, where can people find Creator Science? Where can they find you on the internet?
Yeah, check out the Creator Science podcast. It's just called Creator Science. And wherever you tend to hang out on social media, you can find me, Jay Klaus, on there.
And what will they find when they find you?
They will find a lot of analytical, nerdy looking into how the business of content creation works. I really try to apply an analytical, evidence-backed lens towards this stuff. I can still improve on that for sure, but that's where I'm coming from, is saying, if you are not just an artist savant, let me give you some data-backed insight into how you can get better performance out of your content.
And I'll just add that Jay is a great interviewer and has many very interesting guests on his podcast, so I'd highly recommend listening to the Creator Science podcast.
Thank you for saying that.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Work Less, Earn More. Now, if you want even more where this came from, then I want to tell you about my brand new podcast series called The 100K Method. So this is just a 10-episode limited podcast series where I break down the entire 100K Method, which is my automated sales funnel strategy that I use for all of the automated sales systems in my business and the sales system that I teach to all my top-level clients. So all you need to do to listen to this series and to learn all about the 100K method, how it works, and how to install it in your business so you can start earning passive income each and every month is search for the 100K method in your favorite podcast app, probably the one you have open right now. Again, just search for the 100K method. Or alternatively, just search for my name, Gillian Perkins, in your podcast app, and it should pop up that way too. I'm also going to include a link to it in the show notes for this episode so you can find it easily that way as well. Like I said, the 100K Method is just a 10-episode podcast, so you can easily listen to the entire thing. You'll know exactly which episode to start with, episode one, and you can binge listen all the way through to learn everything you need to know about how the 100K Method works and how it can enable you to earn a whole lot more passive income in your business. I hope you really enjoy it, and if you do, be sure to leave it a review to help more people find it. All right, well, that's all for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back again next week with another one. Until then, stay focused and keep taking action.